This is Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. It's our prayer here at Mission to Israel that our time together will inspire you, give you insight into current events, and reveal your place in God's plan. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scottsbluff, Nebraska, 69363. Or contact us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
Romans 8:28. You want to quote it with me? And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. Emphasis on all things. This will be A Man After Yahweh's Own Purpose, Part 14. Joseph's life is certainly depicted. Man, you could say it's summed up by Romans 8:28. And especially now that we've got to this part of his story, it's becoming even more evident, of course, than before. It is summed up by Romans 8:28. But his life was also epitomized as a man who waited upon Yahweh. He waited upon him as a youth. He waited upon him in slavery. He waited upon him in prison. And he even waited upon him while on the throne. He waited, and he waited, and he waited, and he waited upon Yahweh to fulfill his purpose in his life. That is, to do with him as he saw fit. It's what Paul wrote about in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, where Paul said those very familiar words, I'm sure, to all of us, where he said, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but it is he who lives in me, the Christ who lives in me, and the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith. You could say, waiting upon Yahweh. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and delivered himself up for me. It's essentially the same thing, and it's the same thing that's found with all of those who were men and women after the purpose of Yahweh, and found many expressed in many different ways throughout his entire word, Old and New Testament alike. Now, in the last message, if you'll recall, I discussed the idea of running ahead of God, which is truly a ridiculous, if and even impossible, notion. You know, you'll hear people talk about running ahead of God. But as I pointed out also in the last message, it is a ridiculous and it is an impossible notion, because to run ahead of God would mean that you have outran God. What irony. Because, quote unquote, running ahead of God is more often than not actually a pretext, a ruse for running away from God. Which, as proven again by Jonah, is as impossible as it was for him to outrun God, or in his case, to outswim God. It's simply impossible, and it's a ridiculous idea. Know this, Yahweh will have. You may try to outrun him. You may try to run away from him. You may try to outswim him. You may try to outdo or to do something outdo him in one fashion or another. But know this, Yahweh will have his way with you one way or the other. Praise Yahweh. Because whether it comes easily or more difficult, or in a more difficult fashion, all will work together for your good. Provided you love him. And you're seeking his purpose in your life rather than your own. My encouragement to you is, of course, to seek him, to begin waiting upon him as early as possible. And I'm speaking in regards to both your life in general, the earlier the better, and every day in your life, the earlier the better. Because the sooner you do in your life and in each day of your life, the sooner, Isaiah 40 and verse 31, those who wait upon Yahweh will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. Will the sooner in your life and the sooner each day in your life, the sooner that that passage will become a reality in your life and in your day. Even when everything appears to be going wrong. And if you're not convinced of that possibility, even that potentiality, I encourage you again to read, in fact, to memorize 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9, and 2 Corinthians chapter 6, 9 and 10. Now, let's turn to Genesis chapter 42 and back to the story where we left it off. Genesis chapter 42. We left off in Joseph's and now in his brother's story again. They're now back in the picture, aren't they? Seemed like it was just Joseph's story for a long time there, but it was both Joseph's and their story all along, and now they're back in the picture. You know, it's been said, on your way to the top, be real careful to treat others as you would want to be treated, because you might just meet the same people on the way back down. So we left off in Joseph's and now in his brother's story again, with his brothers, at least nine of them, having returned to their father with their sacks filled with more than just grain. If you'll recall, when they opened their sacks, they not only found the corn, but also the money by which they had bought the corn. And they were afraid, we're told. Afraid, as I pointed out, when they should have been rejoicing, and thereby, listen to me, experiencing. Had they only rejoiced, if they'd have rejoiced instead of being afraid, they would have therefore, if they had believed and thereby experienced by faith the joy that results in trusting in Yahweh's sovereignty, rejoicing because this would indeed work together for their good. Did it not? We know the end of the story. They didn't know the end of the story, their story, but we know the end of the story. It was all for naught that they were afraid, because this would have, by faith, they could have experienced it if by faith they'd simply had believed in the sovereignty of their God. And if you believe in Yahweh's sovereignty, and in Romans 8:28, you don't have to, as I pointed out, I believe, earlier in this series, you don't have to know the conclusion of your story either. You only have to believe in Yahweh and that he's a rewarder of those who believe in him. And you can rejoice instead of fearing and fretting over everything that comes along, just like they did. You know, we're to learn not only from Joseph, but we're to learn from all that are found in any one particular story, including his brothers and his father in this case, who should have rejoiced instead of being afraid. Now, before picking it up where we left off in the biblical account, let me backtrack just a little and share with you some more from Jasher's account. Jasher chapter 51 provides extra detail regarding when Jacob sent his 10 sons to Egypt the first time for provisions, which in turn sheds additional light on Joseph's brother and their change of heart and character. Jasher, beginning with chapter 51 in verse 1, it says, and this picks it right up with that particular point in the biblical account, it says, "And Jacob afterward heard that there was corn in Egypt, and he called unto his sons to go to Egypt to buy corn, for upon them also did the famine prevail, and he called unto his sons." Jumping down to verse 4, and it says, "And Jacob their father commanded them, saying, when you come into the city..." Now listen to this. He says, when you go into the city of the principal city of Egypt, "when you come into the city, do not enter together into one gate on account of the inhabitants of the land. Now, I don't have a clue what's meant by that instruction, by the last part, because on account of the inhabitants of the land. Why? Because of the inhabitants of the land, he would send them into 10 different gates. I don't understand that, but those instructions are pertinent to what occurs after Jacob's 10 sons enter the city. Jasher 51, picking up with verse 5 and 6, it says, "And the sons of Jacob went forth, and they went into Egypt. And the sons of Jacob did all as their father had commanded them." Excuse me. "And Jacob did not send Benjamin, for he said, lest an accident might befall him on the road, like his brother. And the ten of Jacob's sons went forth." Verse 6. "And whilst the sons of Jacob were going on the road, they repented of what they had done to Joseph. And they spoke to each other, saying, 'We know that our brother Joseph went down to Egypt, and now we will seek him where we go, and if we find him, we will take him from his master for a ransom.'" So they were willing to pay to get him back. "And if not, by force, and we will die for him." Wow, quite a change from 22 years previous. Going on, verse 7, "And the sons of Jacob agreed to this thing and strengthened themselves on account of Joseph to deliver him from the hand of his master. And the sons of Jacob went into Egypt. And when they were near to Egypt, they separated from each other, and they came through 10 gates of Egypt. And the gatekeepers wrote their names on that day and brought them to Joseph in the evening." We'd read about that previously. And so here this day, they're going to bring all of the names that's been written down at all of the different gates and bring them now before Joseph. Now, consider what's happening here from Joseph's perspective. Joseph's not privy to his father's instructions to his ten sons in this case. Therefore, his brother's actions in this regard, to come to Egypt and then to go through 10 different gates, separate from each other, had to give him reason to suspect their intentions. Verses 8 and 10 of Jasher 51. "And Joseph read the names from the hand of the gatekeepers of the city, and he found that his brethren had entered in at the 10 gates of the city. And Joseph at that time commanded that it should be proclaimed throughout the land of Egypt, saying, 'Go forth, all ye store guards, close all the corn stores, and let only one remain open.'" So they just entered the cities. They just arrived the day before. He knows they haven't gone to any of the corn stores yet. So he says, "Close them all down and leave only one open, that those who come may purchase from it." Verse 10, "And all the officers of Joseph did so at that time, and they closed all the stores and left only one open." Now, of course, the purpose in all of that is self-evident. This, of course, would ensure that Joseph would have the opportunity to confront all 10 brothers. If they went to different store places to buy their food, then certainly some of them might have left the city before he had that opportunity. Verse 11, "And Joseph gave the written names of his brethren to him that was set over the open store. And he said unto him, 'Whosoever shall come to thee to buy corn, ask his name. And when men of these names shall come before thee, seize them and send them.' And they did so." Now, I'll skip over some of the account here, but because of Joseph's, this is going to what the brothers then did after they come to the city, and skipping over some of it, but nonetheless, because of Joseph's extremely good looks, just filling in a little bit of the details here without reading it all, because of his extremely good looks, Jasher says that they figured he would have been sold. You know, they've got this huge city to go through, so they've got to try to figure, where is the most likely place we're going to find Joseph? And why they figured this, I don't know. But they somehow figured that because of his extremely good looks, that he'd be sold to the keepers of the harlots. And therefore, they spent the next 3 days searching for Joseph at the wall of the harlots. Now, picking it up from there, verses 17 through 22. "And Joseph continued to send 16 servants to seek his brothers, and they went and spread themselves in the four corners of the city. And 4 of the servants went into the house of the harlots, and they found the 10 men there seeking their brother. And those 4 men took them and brought them before him, and they bowed down to him to the ground. And Joseph was sitting upon his throne in the temple, clothed with his princely garments, and upon his head was a large crown of gold. And all the mighty men were sitting around him. And the sons of Jacob saw Joseph, And his figure and comeliness and dignity of countenance seemed wonderful in their eyes, and they again bowed down to him to the ground. And Joseph saw his brethren and knew them, but they knew him not, for Joseph was very great in their eyes, therefore they knew him not. And Joseph spoke to them, saying, "From whence come ye?" And they all answered and said, "Thy servants have come from the land of Canaan to buy corn, for the famine prevails throughout the earth. And thy servants heard that there was corn in Egypt, so they have come amongst the other comers to buy corn for their support." Now, how do you think he's going to respond to them? Verse 22. And Joseph answered them, saying, "If you have come to purchase as you say, why do you come through 10 gates of the city? It can only be that you have come to spy through the land." End of quote. Kind of adds a little bit more to why Joseph accuses them in the biblical accounts of being spies. Perhaps very good reason, if this is indeed what occurred. And of course, his brothers genuinely deny the accusation of spying, and even in the Jasher account, even reveal to Joseph at that time that they were searching for him. But Joseph's obviously not yet convinced. After all, why isn't Benjamin with them? So he detains Simeon and sends the other 9 back to their father with their sacks full of grain and also the silver that they had used to purchase the grain. Was it just out of the goodness of his heart? Or perhaps was it to see if their newfound integrity could be bought off? Listen, integrity, genuine, real integrity, cannot be bought off. Integrity excludes, it eliminates that possibility entirely. And if your quote-unquote integrity can be bought for any price, then it was never integrity in the first place. It's simply your preferred lifestyle at the time. That is, until the way that you've chosen to live, until a better offer comes along. It wasn't integrity. It's simply your preferred way of life. Take Balaam, for example. While appearing to be a prophet of Yahweh, he had no integrity whatsoever, did he? Because he could be bought off, because he was bought off in one sense, and later pays the price by his own death. Appeared to be this mighty, great prophet of Yahweh, who would only say what Yahweh intended. But he had no integrity, because indeed he was bought off. And by the way, beware, because there are still many Balaams today as well. There's lots of them. All right, back now to the biblical account where we left off. We left off with Genesis chapter 42 and verse 35, so let's pick it up there again. Verse 35, "And it came to pass, as they emptied their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid." Verse 36, "And Jacob their father said unto them, Me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not." Now remember, they've come back. Not only have they just now emptied their sacks, found the money, but they came back and told the story of what had happened, that Simeon is back in prison, and that he's requiring that Benjamin now go back with them. And so he says, "And Jacob their father said unto them, Me ye have bereaved my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away? All these things are against me." Now, Jacob responds, at least in part of his response, and he says, "All of these things are against me." You know, have you ever felt like that in your life? You know, it seems like everything's going wrong. All these things are against me. But were they? Not at all. They weren't against him, they were for him. All this was working to Jacob's good. It's too bad he didn't believe it, and thereby alleviate all of his unnecessary concerns, worries, and grieving. Listen to me again. Faith in Yahweh's sovereignty in his control over our lives is the only thing that will make it possible, now listen to me, for us to experience the blessing, for us to experience, doesn't mean experience in the sense that I'm talking about, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but for us to experience, especially Romans 8:28, when everything is, excuse me, when everything seems like it's going wrong. You've got to believe. That is probably the most important lesson of this entire series when it comes to Romans 8:28 at least. It is believing. You know, the question that we need to be asking, or you should be asked, or I and I should be asked, is do you believe in his sovereignty in all things? You know, it's easy to say, I believe in the sovereignty of God. Well, do you? Do you believe in the sovereignty of God in all things at all times? Or are you just a fair weather believer? The way we live during the inclement weather is the answer to that question. Do we rejoice, or do we worry, or do we fear? And again, we're all prone to that. But when it happens, let this be a reminder to you. You want to experience Romans 8:28 during the inclement weather? Then you've got to believe and rejoice in his sovereignty, and that indeed he is, and at that very moment is working together for good in your life. All right, back to the Genesis account. Genesis 42, verses 37 and 38. And Reuben spake up unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee, deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. And he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead. And he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in which ye go, then shall you bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. Now, back to verse 37. And Reuben spake unto his father, saying, slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him, Benjamin, into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. He says, but I'll give you my two sons in place of him if I don't. Now note, it's Reuben again. It was Reuben, if you recall, who intended to deliver Joseph from his brother's hands at the very beginning. And here it is, Reuben again, who offers his two sons as security for Benjamin's life. But Jacob's not convinced and declines Reuben's offer. Later, Judah does essentially the same thing. Skip over to Genesis 43 and look at verses 8 and 9 with me. Verse 8, and Judah said unto Israel his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we and thou and also our little ones, I will be surety for him. Of my hand shall thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. Noble. What Reuben and Judah does in those two situations, noble, what some might even call gallant gestures. But was Reuben and Judah's offer wise? Note in Genesis 43:9 the word surety. Judah offers himself as surety for Benjamin. But what does the Bible say about going surety or providing security or a guarantee on behalf of someone else? Turn, let's keep your place there, but turn to Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6, beginning with verse 1, it says, my son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, and notice it doesn't say with what you've done it with, it just says surety, period. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, so whether it be friend or stranger, verse 2, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth. Thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now then, my son, and deliver thyself when thou art come into the hand of thy friend. Go humble thyself and make sure thy friend. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thy eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter. and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. He says, you're just like a hunted bird or animal if you have gone surety for your neighbor. Proverbs 11:15. Three times God deals with it through Solomon in the book of Proverbs, so you know it's important. Proverbs 11:15. He that is surety for a stranger shall smart. Our New American Standard says suffer for it. And he that hateth suretyship is sure. The New American Standard says safe. And then in Proverbs 17:18, it says, a man void of understanding, a dimwit, is the way we'd maybe say it today, striketh hands and becometh surety in the presence of his friend. Now, those passages are usually understood to refer to money or possessions guaranteed as security. And Yahweh declares the person who would do so a fool, a simpleton. Well, how much more so to offer yourself or your children as security? But why do you suppose Yahweh would identify what appears to be a friendly, benevolent gesture as foolish and sometimes even dangerous? Why would he do? Seems like a kind thing to do, bail your buddy out. Why? You maybe see why it would be stupid and foolish to do it with a stranger, but God says stranger or friend alike. Relative, don't do it. It's foolish. Why, what seems to be a benevolent gesture, would God call it foolish? Surety contracts are actually folly for both parties involved. And here's the reason. Because trust is being placed in finite man who cannot guarantee, now think about this, who cannot guarantee he'll be alive to uphold his part of the bargain the day following. There's no guarantee there whatsoever. He may get run over by a donkey. Or, and today, he might just get run over on the curb by a car. Or who knows what else. Martin Luther commented upon the person who becomes surety on behalf of someone else. Quote, his own life and property are never for a single moment any more secure on certain than those the man for whom he becomes surety. So it's foolishness on both parts. Doesn't matter. And that's a fact. None of us knows what tomorrow holds. Surety demands that you not only guarantee the loan, but also your future. A presumption that the Bible identifies as arrogance. Proverbs 27:1, boast not thyself of tomorrow. That's what you do when you guarantee and you go surety for someone. Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth. Or Acts chapter 1 and verse 7, it is not for you to know the times and the seasons which the Father has put in his own power. Or especially James 4:13-16, go to now ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain, whereas you know not what shall be on tomorrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanishes away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. You rejoice in your boastings, your arrogance, that you're going to go do this and do that. All such rejoicing is evil. In other words, man is notorious for making grand and extravagant plans, or even small and trivial plans for that matter, without so much as giving Yahweh a thought, let alone seeking his direction and his protection in wherever man might find himself going. Neither Reuben nor Judah could guarantee, they had no right to even suggest that they could guarantee what would happen to Benjamin, or even themselves, for that matter, on their trip to Egypt and back. Now, I'm sure that Reuben, speaking of him in particular, was quite confident that he would bring Benjamin back. He'd do everything in his power to bring Benjamin back. Or I can't imagine him offering his two sons as surety. And of course, it was pretty unlikely that had he not returned with Benjamin, that Jacob would have killed his own grandsons. So it was a pretty safe bet either way. But Nonetheless, there was no way that Reuben could guarantee success. I mean, think about it. He couldn't even guarantee Joseph's safety while he was there with his brothers at the time. How does he think he's going to ensure Benjamin's life on a trip that hasn't even taken place, hasn't even begun? James 5 and verse 12, it says, but above all things, my brethren, swear not. You know, taking a vow or take an oath, guaranteeing this, on your life or someone else's life or whatever else it may be. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, on your children's lives or your mother's grave, as some people are inclined to do. But let your yea be yea, and let your nay be nay, lest ye fall into condemnation. Matthew 5, 33 through 37 provides essentially the same admonition and adds some to it. It says, again, we have heard that it has been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shall perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shall thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not. That's what Judah did, essentially. He says, don't swear by your head. Don't guarantee yourself. He says, neither shall thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. Reuben and Judah, they couldn't turn one hair of their hair a different color. And I know they can do it today. They can turn it green and purple, and well, that's another matter. But they couldn't. They couldn't, had they tried, had changed one hair of their head to a different color. Verse 37 of Matthew 5. But let your communication, again, he says, as James did, let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For, it says, whatever is more than these cometh from evil. Ah, how we're inclined to want to swear on our mother's grave or swear on the Bible. Any more than yea, yea, and nay, nay, he says, cometh from evil. Unless, let me tell you, unless you are absolutely certain, and there are very, very few things that we can be absolutely certain about, but unless you're absolutely certain that you can keep your word, better not to vow at all, or to guarantee, which was essentially the same thing as what they were doing. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 4, when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. You better be sure that you can fulfill the vow. Well, somebody might say, well, I'm not vowing. I won't vow to God. You know, I'm not going to do that. Well, you better keep in mind that as Christians, everything we do is to be done unto him and in the name of our Savior. Colossians 3, 17 to 23, 17, and whatsoever you do, everything in your life, from the moment you get out of bed to the moment you go to bed, and whatsoever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Yahshua, giving thanks unto the God the Father in him, or by him. And then in verse 23, and whatsoever you do, from the time you get out of bed to the time you go to bed, and whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord, and not unto men. And Romans 14 and verse 8, where it says, for whether we live unto the Lord, or whether we die unto the Lord. Whether we live, therefore, or die, we are the Lord's. Say, I'm not making a vow to God. Oh, no, I'm not going to do that. Well, everything you do as Christian is to be done unto him. If you might say as a vow unto him. Better be careful. And yet it is amazing to me, with that in mind, it is amazing to me how little sometimes one's word means to many Christians. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 5, it says, better it is that thou shouldest not vow, to give your word, whether it be to God or man. Better it is that thou vowest that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Otherwise, better that it be that you not vow. Otherwise, just simply let your yea be yea and your nay, nay. You know, if your word is good, that's really the only guarantee you need, that you need to give. Your word, my word, you've got my word. Yea, yea, nay, nay. That's what it'll be. But you will have to have established a track record of keeping your word for that to be the case, even in the smallest of matters. Because who's going to trust you with the greater matters if you haven't proven yourself faithful in the smaller matters? Being where you said you're going to be at a certain time. Calling if you're not going to be there. Doing whatever it takes to be a man of your word and establishing that track record. All right, back to Genesis chapter 43. We'll pick it back up where we left off. Finish 42, so let's start with Genesis 43, verses beginning, with, of course, with verse 1. And it says, "And the famine was sore in the land, and it came to pass, when they had eaten up the corn which they had brought out of Egypt, their father said unto them, Go again, buy us a little food." You wonder, ever wondered how long it was between the time they brought the food back and the time they ran out of it? How much food could nine donkeys, because they could only take one donkey apiece, how much grain could nine donkeys bring back? Well, Jasher says that, according to Jasher, the corn from the first trip lasted a year and 2 months. So that's the time that's elapsed between the time they left Egypt and now they're once again out of corn. Again, barely into the 7 years. There may be about 3 years. They aren't even halfway into the famine yet. All right, picking it up with verse 3. "And Judah spake unto him, saying, The man did solemnly protest unto us, saying, You shall not see." His dad says, "Go, get some corn again. Get up. Get off your duffs. Get her done." "And Judah spake unto him, saying, The man did solemnly protest unto us, saying, Ye shall not see my face, except your brother be with you. If thou wilt send our brother with us, we will go down and buy thee food. But if thou wilt not send him, we will not go down. For the man said unto us, You shall not see my face, except your brother be with you." And I'm sure they believed him. Verse 6, "And Israel said, Wherefore dealt ye so ill with me as to tell the man whether ye had yet a brother? Why'd you even tell him you had another brother? You didn't have to do that. And they said, The man asked us straitly of our state and of our kindred, saying, Is your father yet alive? Have ye another brother? And we told him according to the tenor of these words. Could we certainly know that he would say, Bring your brother down? It wasn't our fault, Dad. And Judah said unto Israel his father, Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and thou, and also our little ones." Boy, their ace card was that they were all going to die, Benjamin included. You weren't going to save him, Dad. I'm sure they pointed that out to him. One way or the other, he's going to die, and possibly if you send him with us, he won't. But if you don't, we're dying, and he too. Verse 9, "And I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. For except we had lingered, surely now we had returned this second time. If he'd let us gone, you know, a month ago, we'd be back." Now, although scripturally foolish, note it's Judah this time whose idea it was to sell Joseph, whose idea it was to sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites, who's offering himself as security for Benjamin. More evidence that Joseph's brothers' consciences had finally kicked in and were truly repentant for their actions against Joseph. All right, verse 11. "And their father Israel said unto them, If it must be so, now do this. Take of the best fruits in the land in your vessels, and carry down the man a present, a little balm and a little honey, spices and myrrh, nuts and almonds. And take double money in your hand, and the money that was brought again in the mouth of your sacks, carried again in your hand. Peradventure it was an oversight. Take also your brother, and arise, go again unto the man, and God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may send away your other brother and Benjamin. If I be bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. Jasher, of course, adds some more to the story once again. Reading from Jasher 52 in verses 26 through 29, it says, "And Jacob arose from his sons and spread forth his hands." This is right after what we just left off. "And Jacob rose up from his sons and spread forth his hands, and he prayed unto the Lord on account of his sons, saying," listen to this prayer, "O Lord God of heaven and earth, remember the covenant with our father Abraham. Remember it with our father Isaac, and deal kindly with my sons, and deliver them not into the hands of the king of Egypt. Do it, I pray thee, O God, for the sake of thy mercies, and redeem all of my children, and rescue them from the Egyptian power, and send them their two brothers." You know, men, that's a prayer. You know, may not be that, certainly isn't, that we have to worry about our children being taken by another nation somewhere in captivity. But they should sure be taken in captivity spiritually. And perhaps physically right here in our own nation. Great example of a prayer that we need to pray probably at least weekly for our children as well. Continuing verse 27, "And all the wives of the sons of Jacob and their children lifted up their eyes to heaven, and they all wept before the Lord, and cried unto him to deliver their fathers from the hand of the king of Egypt. And Jacob wrote a record to the king of Egypt, and gave it." So he not only prayed for them, he not only sent them on their way, he now prays for them, which we know he must have done. Jasher provides us the prayer. But he also now writes a record, it says. "And Jacob wrote a record to the king of Egypt, and gave it into the hand of Judah, and into the hands of his sons for the king of Egypt, saying, From thy servant Jacob, son of Isaac, son of Abraham, the Hebrew, the prince of God, to the powerful and wise king, the revealer of secrets, king of Egypt, greeting." Now, I won't read all of Jacob's letter. If you're interested and you got the book of Jasher, you can do that on your own, or you can get the book of Jasher off the internet. But let me at least share part of it. After introducing himself and explaining his son's actions, some of what I do want to read to you, he also takes a pretty strong, if even threatening, stance with the Zaphnath-Paneah. Verses 33 through 42, a little bit long, but worth the read, I think. Verse 33, "Have we not heard," he continues on and he says, "have we not heard concerning thee that thou didst interpret Pharaoh's dream and didst speak truly unto him?" Now catch this. "How then dost thou not know in thy wisdom whether my sons are spies or not?" Pretty good question. Puts him on the spot. But then listen to the following. "Now therefore, my lord and king, behold, I have sent my son before thee, as thou didst speak unto my sons. I beseech thee to put thy eyes upon him until he is returned to me in peace with his brethren," speaking, of course, of Benjamin. Verse 35, "For dost thou not know, or hast thou not heard, that which our God did unto Pharaoh when he took my mother Sarah? And what he did unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, on account of her? And also what our father Abraham did unto the nine kings of Elam, how he smote them all with a few men that were with him." Verse 36, "And also what my two sons, Simeon and Levi, did unto the eight cities of the Amorites, how they destroyed them on account of their sister Dinah." Eight cities, not just one. "And also on account of their brother Benjamin, they consoled themselves for the loss of his brother Joseph." Catch that. You know, in other words, somewhere very soon after they had sold Joseph into Egypt, their conscience already had started to prick them, so much so that they took special care of Benjamin. And so he says, "And also on account of their brother Benjamin, they consoled themselves for the loss of his brother Joseph. What will they then do for him when they see the hand of any people prevailing over them for his sake? Dost thou not know, O king of Egypt, that the power of God is with us, and that also God ever heareth our prayers and forsaketh us not all our days? Should we not be so bold ourselves?" It's the same God, and we're the same people. He did the same things for as much for our relatives as he did for Jacob's. Made the same covenant with our forefathers. We should be so bold. Verse 39, and when my sons told me of thy dealings with them, I called not unto the Lord on account of thee, for then thou wouldest have perished with thy men before my son Benjamin came before thee. But I thought that as Simeon, my son, was in thy house, perhaps thou mightest deal kindly with him. Therefore I did not this thing unto thee. Did he deal kindly with Simeon? Don't know yet, do we? Just a thought there. Verse 40, now therefore, behold, Benjamin, my son, cometh unto thee with my sons. Take heed of him and put thy eyes upon him, and then will God place his eyes over thee and throughout thy kingdom. In other words, look kindly upon him, and God will look kindly upon you. Verse 41, now I have told thee all that is in my heart, and behold, my sons are coming to thee with their brother. Examine the face of the whole earth for their sake, and send them back in peace with their brethren. And Jacob gave the record to his sons into the care of Judah to give it unto the king of Egypt. In other words, Jacob was declaring to Zaphnath-Paneah, if you won't do what's righteous for righteousness' sake, then you'd better do it for the fear of our God. Pretty interesting letter. Pretty bold letter. All right, now back to the Genesis account. Genesis chapter 43, picking up with verse 15. And the men took that present, and they took double money in their hand, and Benjamin, and rose up and went down into Egypt and stood before Joseph. And when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the ruler of his house, bring these men home and slay and make ready, for these men shall dine with me at noon. And the man did as Joseph bade, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house. And the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house. And they said, because of the money that was returned in our sacks at the first time, are we brought in that he may seek occasion against us. So they had been somewhere in the outer perimeters of his palace at some now point. Now they're in his living quarters. And they think, why in the world would this guy bring us here? That he may seek occasion against us and fall upon us and take us for bondmen and our asses. And they came near to the steward of Joseph's house, and they communed with him at the door of the house and said, O sir, we came indeed down at the first time to buy food. So this is someone who can speak their language. Rather than going to Joseph, who they think can't speak their language, they go to the steward. And it came to pass when we came to the inn that we opened our sacks, and behold, every man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, and we have brought it again in our hand. Now, let me just stop there. This is, again, one of those extras for free, but something I want you to at least think about. Did you catch the last phrase? Look at verse 21 again. The last phrase, it says, and was every man's money was in his mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. Note, in order to be genuine or for money to be real money, it must have weight. And different amounts must have different weights and sizes, because the different weights would determine the different size in most cases. Now, take out a $100 bill out of your wallet or your purses. I know you've all got one there. Take it out, and I want you to place your right hand, put it in your left hand, place your right hand on it. Let's close our eyes, and we'll all pray over that as the offering plate is passed. No, that's not what. Take out a $100 bill, take out a $50 bill, take out a $20 bill, take out a $10 bill, a $5 bill, and a $1 bill, and weigh and measure all of them. And surprise, surprise, you'll find, and by the way, this will be a revelation to some people, and I'm not kidding. It was to me the first time it was pointed out to me, and never thought about it, never dawned on me. They don't want you thinking about it. But you'll find that first, they all have virtually no weight whatsoever. There's no hardly any weight to them. And they all weigh and measure exactly the same. The $1 bill weighs and measures the exact same weight and measurement as does the $100 bill. Whoa! You know, and for those hearing this and thinking about it for the first time, ought to be thinking to themselves, what's going on here? Somebody's done a job on us. And as I mentioned in my series, Principles of Biblical Economics, the only thing that makes the purchasing power of the $100 bill more than the purchasing power of the $1 bill, it's not because of its weight and size, its substance. And so the only thing that makes the purchasing power of the $100 bill more than the purchasing power of the $1 bill is faith. That's it. Today's economic system is therefore a belief, a religious system. Don't think that economics is outside the area of spirituality or religion. It's a major part of it. Read your Bibles. God deals with money time and time and time again in the word, in His Word. And our economic system is a faith system, is a religious system, because it has nothing to do with just weights and measures, but instead with faith. And therefore, watch out for the day when the populace becomes informed and stops believing. Something's going to happen. All right, enough on that. That's just to get you thinking on another thought there. Back to Genesis 43. Pick it up with verse 21. And it came to pass, when we came to the inn, that we opened our sacks, and behold, every man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. And we have brought it again in our hand. And other money have we brought down in our hands to buy food. We cannot tell who put our money in our sacks. And he said, peace be to you, fear not. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. And he brought Simeon out to them. Well, thankfully, they passed the test. They had true integrity. They would not sell their integrity for the money that had been put back in their sacks. And they brought it again. Also, it says there that they brought Simeon unto them. Jasher adds this, 53 in verse 5. It says, and Simeon said unto his brethren, the Lord of the Egyptians has acted very kindly unto me. Just as you had expected. He did not keep me bound, as you saw with your eyes. For when you went out from the city, he let me free and dealt kindly with me in his house. And so it was a year and 2 months. What's been going on with Simeon? He's been living pretty high on the hog. Joseph wasn't going to retaliate to Simeon what Simeon had done to him. He would not take out his own vengeance. Back to Genesis 43, verse 24. And a man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their asses provender, and they made ready the present against Joseph came at noon, for they heard that they should eat bread there. I read as far as I wanted to. And they made ready the present against Joseph. Against Joseph came at noon, for they heard that they should eat bread there. Now, what present is it talking about? They made ready the present. Well, look at verse 11 again. It says, then their father Israel said unto them, It must be so. Then do this. Take some of the best products of the land in your bags, and carry down to the man as a present a little balm and a little honey, aromatic gum and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. You know, Jacob understood what Solomon wrote. Proverbs 18:16, a man's gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. Or Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 14, a gift in secret subdues anger. You know, Jacob had personally experienced the latter with his brother Esau. Remember the fabulous gifts he sent out? Droves beforehand to subdue the anger of Esau when he was returning to his father. And therefore, he knew the power of an honest gift. You may think, you may be wondering, honest gift, you know, is there such a thing as a dishonest gift? Sure there is. It's called a bribe. But Jacob's gift was no bribe, but simply done to win favor in the eyes of Zaphnath-Paneah. All right, verses 26 and 28, about out of time here, so we'll go as far as we can. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed themselves to him to the earth. And he asked them of their welfare and said, is your father well, the old man of whom he spake? Is he yet alive? And they answered, thy servant our father is in good health, he is yet alive. And they bowed down their heads and made obeisance. Joseph's dreams, Yahweh's word, once again fulfilled. Verse 29 through 34. And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's sons, and said, is this your younger brother of whom you spake unto me? I know, keep in mind, he hasn't seen his brother for 24, 25 years now. His beloved full brother. And it says, is this your brother? Is this your brother, your younger brother of whom you spake of me? And he said, God be gracious unto thee, my son. Then verse 30, he says, "And Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother, and he sought where to weep, and he entered into his chamber and wept there." The heart of the man. You know, here was his brother he hadn't seen in 24 years. What else could the man do? Because he wasn't yet ready to reveal himself. And he left the room to weep. Verse 31, "And he washed his face and went out and refrained himself and said, Set on bread. And they set on him for by himself and for them by themselves and for the Egyptians which he did eat with them by themselves, because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled at one another." How in the world can this guy do this? You know, the odds. I saw the odds once of him getting all 11 brothers in the right order. I mean, it was phenomenal for him as a stranger to do so. Of course, he was no stranger, but they had to be thinking, how in the world? Well, guess what? Get to the book of Jasher, and it adds a whole nother perspective to this seating and also what was to follow. We don't have time. I was planning that, but we don't have time, so you have to come back for the next message. Verse 34, "And he took and sent messes unto them before him, but Benjamin's mess was five times so much as any of theirs, and they drank and were merry with him." You know, it seems like he gave them clues all the way along. Well, why is Benjamin getting so much? Man, he's the youngest. He never gets the most. He always gets the leftovers. Well, there was a clue there. But they did not pick up on it or any of the clues that Joseph had gave all along. But it's soon to come to a climax. The plot thickens. And if you want to know what happens next, both from the biblical account and also Jasher's account, which adds much more, you'll have to come back. All right, let's stand. We'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we are thankful again for your word and all that it holds. We're thankful for the account of Jasher that your word also points us to, that we can perhaps see a little bit clearer this story than what you provided in the canon of your scripture. We're thankful that it's been revealed and provides us, Father, with a fuller story. Thank you for, Lord, the story and all the lessons therein that we can learn, the side points and the main points and all that, Father, we can learn in trying to be like Joseph, men and women after the not only the heart, but Father, the purpose of Yahweh as well. Direct our paths, make them straight, guide us, guide our children in your ways, help them to know that you have a future plan for them. If they'll only remain true to you, that they'll trust you now and throughout the rest of their lives. We glorify you and praise you and thank you. For